the Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It is 7:30 on this Tuesday morning, and you're very welcome along to OTB AM. It is Owen and Johnny Ward with you right the way through until 9:30 this morning. A very relieved Johnny Ward, I think it's fair to say. Cheltenham receiving the green light there basically yesterday.
It's looking good, Owen, yeah. It looked a bit precarious for the last week or so, and Betfair have had a market on it, which is usually a good guide. Will Racing go ahead? And I think on Sunday evening, it was at the biggest price yet that it would go ahead, nearly even money, which is nearly 50-50. But after Boris Johnson gave a statement yesterday, I think it was back out to 3 or 4 to 1 last night that it wouldn't go ahead. So it's looking good. Boris saved the day as ever.
What do you do on a week like this? Is it just stocking up on your 5 a day, drinking lots of water, preparing yourself for the marathon that is next week?
Or come into Off the Ball AM.
Off the Ball AM.
It turns out, yeah. Just got a text there for a preview night, which is in the BDO building literally next door.
This is where you make your money.
I've done 6 preview nights this year. One of them, I think I'll be paid for one of them because 5 of them were for charity. So you get a few free pints and sometimes a free meal.
Right.
But,
okay.
It's not really in the spirit.
No such thing as a free meal.
Well, yeah. It's not really in the spirit of things, though, to take money for these charity events. So tomorrow I do a podcast on for Racing TV. And it's still, it's like the last preview night I do is Saturday. So it's still flat out, really, to be honest. Like, and then you're kind of... The coronavirus is a little bit of an issue in the background because it is still a concern. I mean, it would just throw the whole, you know, in terms of your logistics, you've planned for this, you've booked your flights, you've had your bets as well, and the bets would all be rendered redundant. And that is, if you've had bad bets, you might want that to happen. If you've had good bets, you obviously want it to go ahead now. You want to see the bet run. But it's been an anxious enough time, notwithstanding the fact that, obviously, racing's a small fry in the overall scheme of things. But if... I don't see how they could really reschedule it if there's an option, but it's a packed kind of calendar from here on, so it kind of needs to go ahead. I think it should go ahead.
It's not like a match where you can just find a window for it. It is a whole industry moving to one place for a week.
Yeah, Cheltenham has a 2-day meeting in April, and it could stretch that to a 3-day, but that doesn't fit in with the other, like Aintree and Punchestown and all that. So Cheltenham fits in the calendar very well, and. Also, you know, it's been suggested that it could take place behind closed doors. I would not be a fan of that. Cheltenham would be nothing without the people there. And it's part of the challenge for the horses is to deal with the 70 or 80,000 people who are there, deal with the atmosphere. A lot of horses can't. And running it in an empty field, I don't know, I wouldn't be a fan of that now.
Do you get annoyed when fair weather fans are texting you on Tuesday morning saying, any tips?
No, not at all. Like, I mean, if people need to get into racing, I think I like the fact that randomers like racing. And it's a time for people. I got into racing by basically being brought to Cheltenham one year, just brought to the pub and watching a few races, having a few bets, and I was kind of hooked thereafter. So I think we need to get more people into the sport. Like, it's a great sport, and its future is far from secure. Like, at the moment, there's a big... welfare campaign in Britain, which I think is quite well intentioned, in that there was even an ad on Racing TV yesterday now trying to just show that they use the whip, the jockey uses the whip for corrective measures just to be safe, and that horses are very well looked after and all this, because there is a big concern about racing in Britain in terms of welfare, where it's going to end up. Will there be racing in Britain at all in 50 years time? I wouldn't be sure of that, you know. So I think we need to get people into the sport, definitely. I think in Ireland we probably have a more nuanced and realistic take on horse racing, but its future is far from certain. Even in the States, like, you know, people don't really go racing anymore. They just kind of watch it on TV, or they play in the casino. But it doesn't have a guaranteed future by any stretch, racing. So I think we need as many people into it as possible.
Absolutely. 1 week out from Cheltenham 2020. Just to tell you what's going on in the world of sport this morning. Last night in the FA Cup, Arsenal 2-0 winners at Fratton Park. Socrates and Eddie Nketiah with the goals for them. Tonight then, Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp has been saying that their first Premier League defeat of the season away to Watford won't be influencing his team selections. I'm not sure if that means he plays the first team. Does that mean he plays the kids? Probably means it's going to end up somewhere in between. They're away to Chelsea, of course. The other fixtures tonight, Newcastle face a fairly tricky test away to West Brom. Who, of course, are championship leaders. Reading entertaining Champions League hopefuls. Sheffield United In the Championship then last night, Middlesbrough's winless run was extended to 12 games. Missed their chance to move out of the Championship's relegation zone. It was 2-2 at home to Nottingham Forest. Republic of Ireland then, today, it's the big day, UEFA Nations League 2.0. We're going to discover our opponents in Amsterdam. The games are taking place between September and November this year. Russia, Austria, Wales and Czech Republic are the top seeds in our league and all potential opponents for what will by then be Stephen Kenny's side. Scotland are among the sides lurking in pot three. In rugby then, Munster hope to have a fit and healthy Joey Carberry back for pre-season training. So if you missed this news last night, it turns out his season is over, really. So he underwent a second surgery on his ankle, originally injured in August. He had already been sidelined by a wrist tendon injury, suspending his first Munster start of the season, which only came at the end of December. So hopefully he manages to use the gap that comes at the end of the season to get back to full health and get a good run on it next year.
Desperate look for him. Yeah. That, you know, you always worry about young players who have so many injuries, and not only just physically in terms of is this happening for a reason, like is it something that's an issue there, but psychologically it's so tough just to have that road again. And you know, with Ireland's issues at out half, he could have had a very pivotal Six Nations campaign, but he wasn't there, and that mightn't have necessarily helped Johnny Sexton either, that Carberry wasn't there, but it's just been desperately bad luck for him.
Yeah, limited our options as well if we wanted to play two playmakers in the backs or anything like that. Just a final story then, of course, Navin's card on Saturday fell victim to Storm Jorge. That's been rescheduled for today, the first going to post at 20-2. Let's tell you what's coming up this morning on OTB AM. We'll get into the sports pages in just a moment. Phil Thompson then will be with us to talk about Liverpool against Chelsea tonight and whether or not Jurgen Klopp's men can bounce back. Our top five stories coming your way at 8:05, followed by Paul Rouse, who will be with us in studio to talk about the effect of putting sport behind a paywall, because that is the news this week for the Six Nations potentially. The sports news coming your way with Tom Malone at 8:45, and then Graham Hunter will be giving his take on El Clasico at 10-9. Katie McCabe has been in conversation with Shane Hannan ahead of their crucial Euro qualifier against Greece this week. We'll play that interview after 9 o'clock, and then we're talking VR with Jess Kelly after 9:15 and what that technology means for sport. Before all that, it is time for the back pages. OTB AM. And the front page of offtheball.com this morning is Kieran Bradley's fantastic piece on Wimbledon. It's a couple of pieces, a couple of parts, I should say, to this piece. His latest one is about the supposed death of Wimbledon, and Kenny Cunningham has been speaking in this piece. Fans were carrying coffins, Cunningham, on Wimbledon's demise. You said you were... Did you see Wimbledon a couple of years ago?
I did. Kieran Bradley has been off the charts recently. He did a great piece on that Ireland-England game in Lansdowne Road in 25 years ago, wasn't it? And the complexities of being an Irish-English person, or whatever he wants to call himself at that time. That stuff on AFC Wimbledon is fascinating, because I didn't actually fully realise the reasoning behind the move to Milton Keynes, because the guy, the Milton Keynes kind of, I guess the chairman or whatever he was, he wanted to kind of grow his business empire as well, and it suited to have, he had a retail empire of some description, so it suited. But I went to watch him, I went to watch AFC Wimbledon playing Bradford in the ground that they're still in London. It was Kingstonian's ground at the time. Kingstonians have actually left it now. I think they might share it with the Chelsea ladies team. But Bradford were actually playing in the League Cup final the following weekend, which was really weird, because it was like Wimbledon at that time were the worst team in the four divisions, and Bradford were doing well and they were pushing for promotion. But I was in London for the day, and I was saying to my mate, I was like, I wouldn't mind going to a game, but I'd prefer if it were like a lower league game, and that just happened to be the most suitable. But it was really cool, because like there was about 4,000 people at the game, which is quite a crowd for the bottom team in the four tiers, but pretty much everyone was standing, and there was a great atmosphere inside the ground. They won 2-1, and Neil Sullivan was in goal for them, and Neil Sullivan was in his 40s at that stage, but he'd been obviously the mainstay of probably one of the crazy gang teams, I guess, but he was the mainstay. When I was supporting the Premier League when I was a kid, Neil Sullivan was playing for Wimbledon. I'm sure Kenny would have played with him, but he was playing. Alan Bennett was centre back, Cork City now, and they won the game 2-1, and they're now, as Kieran said in his piece, I think they're 3 points behind MK Dons in League One. So they started off in the ninth tier all those years ago, and it's been amazing progress, really. Like, it's, as you know, what's happening at Salford and clubs like that where there's kind of solvent of so much money, it's slightly different. AFC Wimbledon is really fan run, and their big aspiration is to get back to Plough Lane, which they were in 30 odd years ago, which was a Greyhound stadium, but it looks like it's going to happen. And fantastic story, you know, in a football world that's so dominated by money, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a great read. Kieran Bradley working on that piece over recent weeks. Another story on offtheball.com is Brian Kerr talking about his all Cork midfield, because he was at our Pepsi Roadshow on Saturday discussing how he brought Roy Keane back into the fold.
You were obviously, David, after Brian's time as underage coach. Did you play much underage for Ireland?
Because no.
Roy would have this massive chip in his shoulder that...
Oh, I have it too. Don't worry about
the
that.
The Cork lads were ignored.
Oh, they were. Yeah. Still there. Yeah, still there.
I had that discussion with Roy before. You know the whole thing after Saipan, what's going to happen when he's coming back and who's going to get him back? I mean, we were asked that question. I was asked that question at an interview for the job. And I was aware of this that idea. And one of the things that I suggested was, you know, I was trying to, it was something that I loved the idea of bonding players and that challenge of, I used to manage college teams years ago with the All-Ireland Colleges team. And I used to love that idea of pulling the players together from Cork. I was always conscious of that, and I loved it. And I threw one at Roy. I said, look, what about the idea? I said, do you know Miller, you know? And he said, yeah, I know Miller. I said, Do you know Colin Healy, don't you? Now, at that time, both of them were just making their way. They weren't big time. And I said, what about the idea of an all-Cork midfield? You know, so the three of us together in the middle. He said, well, they do the running. He said,
yeah.
My best lane.
Brian Kerr there on our Pepsi Roadshow in Dundrum on Saturday night. Full piece available on youtube.com/offtheball. Let's get into the newspapers this morning. The Irish Examiner goes with what lies ahead. How are Kingston's Cork set for Championship 2020? It's a preview of their season. Winning response, Arsenal bounce back from Europa heartache with cup win at Portsmouth. While John Fogarty is writing about Congress, look but don't touch policy doesn't do hurling any favours. And familiar foe Andy Farrell prepares to pit his wits against Sean Edwards. Note to fans, a Slovakia playoff may have to be played behind closed doors is one of the big themes around the coronavirus story. And class is permanent. Colin Sheridan salutes one of Galway GAA's greatest stars.
Yeah, Michael Donlan.
One of Galway's true great stars, yeah, for sure.
Turns out Shane Hannan just told me he was infatuated by Michael Donlan when he was a kid, because Shane Hannan's dad's from Dunmore and he used to go to league games and get him to sign an autograph and all. But Michael Donlan was, like, I was obviously 15 when Galway won in 98, and he had absolute hero status in Galway. Like, he was just an idol. He ended up playing for Galway United briefly as well, which was interesting. This is the Irish Times. Klopp's faith in Liverpool unbroken, and he says, how could I lambaste my players for the loss at Watford? They tried, you know, they're on a great run, and so on. Interesting tonight to see what sort of team he picks. UEFA still expects your 2020 playoff matches to go ahead. And Gerry Thornley then speaks about the Leinster-Saracens clash may have to take place behind closed doors, but the rest of Six Nations likely to go ahead. And then he has a piece on Andy Farrell and Sean Edwards, who formed a close bond at Wigan.
The Guardian this morning goes with play on for now. Six Nations gets green light for remaining games to go ahead. Betting ban, Sturridge out for 4 more months after FA win case. The main story here, Gunners eye glory after Pompey stroll. And Nketiah provides the finishing touch to ensure Arsenal ease past Portsmouth and keep only hope of a trophy alive with smooth FA Cup victory, a 2-0 win last night at Fratton Park.
How smooth was that win? You were on football watching duty on a Monday night. God help you.
I was, to be honest with you, I was only watching Mike Dean. The game itself was secondary. There was a fantastic moment in the first half. Well, like throughout the entire game, Mike Dean put on a clinic, I think it's fair to say. But in the first half, Matteo Guendouzi was taking a free kick, but the ball was rolling a tiny bit, and Mike Dean pulled him back, being proper pedantic Dean, saying, put that ball back to where it was. So Guendouzi picks up the ball, shakes it in the air, and slams it down on the grass. Unusually, Mike Dean didn't doff his cap and say, well done, I completely appreciate your sassiness, and booked him. Which I guess is kind of ironic, but
we will get
hugely enjoyable.
We will get to the movement of the ball for a set piece later on in the show, because I just want to talk about something at the weekend. Games played in hurricane-like conditions.
Oh yes, we will get that. It wouldn't have helped Mike Dean's cause had there been a hurricane. I said, I would urge and implore every director who is working on a game involving Mike Dean to actually just set up a box where we can just watch Mike Dean's face for the entirety of the 90 minutes.
Did you spend a Monday evening watching a referee?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did that and
say something about your general well-being?
No, absolutely not. It's the best Monday evening I've ever spent. And I will not bow down to anybody else who says that I'm sad for doing that.
Well, I only spoke to a referee yesterday. Spoke to a referee. It was like, God, this guy is actually a real person. That's on referees. Because I have a take on sport that referees don't get the spotlight they deserve because they must be really pissed off and they have a really, really good game and nobody says anything. Like, they'll be slated when they have a bad game. So it's like, oh, the good referee is the lad you don't notice. But, like, the referee who's, like, called everything right and really let the game flow and, you know, made these ridiculously difficult decisions before VAR and all that. And he goes into his car that night. He's not going on social media to see loads of people say he had a great game. So you're probably thinking, they probably do get this kind of slightly different mentality about their job. But anyway, it's interesting that you did that at the same time. So you watched a referee in a game for 90 minutes and I rang one up and I said, can you give me a quote? And he couldn't.
My evening is definitely more productive than that. To be fair, I did watch the kind of sideshow, which was a football match breaking out around Mike Dean here. And Arsenal were impressive at times. Reece Nelson looks to be one of the fastest players I've ever had.
Some young players coming through. Irish Independence, Six Nations, green light for now. Bosses insist speculation around TV sell-off highly premature, and that's obviously something we'll get into with Paul Rowse in terms of free to air and also and so on and so forth. Tunnel brawlers to avoid bans, and that's obviously an OMA, another game that definitely shouldn't have gone ahead. And Ireland lined up for Thomond friendlies in June, which will be quite interesting. The Aviva Stadium will be unavailable, and Ireland will have a little bit of a trek around the country. And it's quite sad that we don't really have any other football stadia in Ireland that they could play in. So they're going to play in Thomond Park. And according to John Fallon, they will take play these Turkey and Luxembourg friendlies are set to play in Thomond Park.
When is that going to take place in June? They're set in stone regardless of whether or not we qualify for Euro 2020.
Mick McCarthy, if he successfully hurdles a couple of playoffs, will have his next match as yet unconfirmed opposition on June 1st. 3 days later, Ireland will meet Turkey June 4th and they'll meet Luxembourg June 9th and the home of Munster Rugby, which I've never actually been to, 25,500 seaters, which is pretty much perfect for an Ireland friendly.
Yeah, absolutely. Back page of the Irish Daily Mail this morning is UEFA lockout. Virus may lead to fan ban from UEFA playoffs, Euro playoffs. So Slovakia are doing random checks basically at their border at the moment to see if people have the coronavirus and seem to be taking it fairly seriously. So there is a possibility that they could play that game behind closed doors, which if we're away from home, that suits us perfectly.
It would definitely be a help. Not sure about all the Ireland fans who've
obviously
who've a jolly on their
mind. Bad news overall because we want Ireland fans to get in there, but maybe on a
I think it'd be better off if we played. For our prospects, we'd be better off if we're behind closed doors.
I think so too. Ready, Eddie, go is the headline from Fratton Park last night. And green light for Ireland's Paris tie with Le Bleu. This is kind of something that's been causing a bit of confusion because the French authorities came out at the weekend and said we will have no public gatherings over 5,000 people.
I think that's indoors or something.
Exactly. Yeah. So actually, because the stadium in Saint-Denis is outdoors, this game is likely to go ahead. So confined spaces, if there was a roof on that thing, if it was at the La Défense Arena, for example, this thing would not be happening.
Some of these many music gigs you go to would be probably under threat.
Under severe threat. Yeah.
This is the Times, the London Times, plan to play games behind closed doors. And it talks about Gareth Southgate considering a call-up for Foden as well. Got a bit of love from Jack Byrne on social media, I saw yesterday. And Sturridge gets banned for betting, and this has been referenced in a few papers. It's quite sad. He's been suspended from all football until June 17th after the FA won an appeal over breaches of betting regulations. Essentially, a bit of insider information. He was kind of talking to his brother about a potential transfer, but it's tough on the player. Very, very tough.
The Irish Mirror this morning leads with empty threat. UEFA warned of behind closed doors playoff contingency plan amid coronavirus fears. So also talk here in a piece of potentially moving the game if it comes to it. But also Paul O'Hare mentions that there's a chance it could be played behind closed doors. And Torreira blow Mars Gunners Cup cruise. That is the other thing that came out of last night's fixture, is that Lucas Torreira left Fratton Park on crutches. The way Fratton Park is, it seemed that he actually had to go back up the tunnel and walk along the pitch. So he had to go up the steps himself on his crutches and then walk out in front of all the cameras. Because I can't imagine he was going onto the pitch for any other reason. So not good news for him.
This is the star, which is a fairly enigmatic Foley. It has a fairly enigmatic photo of Derek Foley. Our man Derek went to Leopardstown yesterday to get some big names in Irish Racing's thoughts on the virus. And he's wearing a mask there. My flatmate gave me a mask to put on at a preview night the other night, but I just forgot, to be honest. But I still have it for one of the preview nights left, so it might get a few laughs.
That would have been a great gag had nobody seen it coming.
Hopefully they didn't listen. But Cheltenham's worries ease, and Niall Blast's rule change. And this is Niall Morgan, the Tyrone goalkeeper, has criticised the retired men, which is a very very spiky comment, who make the rules in the wake of the change to the back pass vote. Actually, was in here on doing the papers on Sunday, and Mick Foley had a great piece on that in the Times. It's just really, really, it set the tone of the whole day of being at this bloody congressing, and how taxing it is in the mind and body, and how the mood was sort of dictated by whether the lads were going for a few pints or not, or whether they'd had a full meal. And some of the rules that were kind of rushed through, important rules changes, like the goalkeeper change, which he said was basically you wouldn't even notice. It was just like one of them things that was kind of rushed through.
And 2 minutes.
2 minute job. And obviously then the Tyrone goalkeeper is having a bit of a dig at why this was brought in, because people maybe that he thinks don't understand the game and so forth.
When I grow up, I want to be a delegate at Congress. It seems like the best job in the world.
I said you want to be Mike Dean.
Well, actually, good point. I don't know which I'd rather be. Maybe Mike Dean at the weekends and the delegates on Friday night. Daily Telegraph this morning. Socrates' super strike. Defender's volley helps sing Brave Pompey to put Arsenal into FA Cup quarterfinals, and Six Nations gets the green light. Cheltenham Festival also goes ahead as fears over postponements due to coronavirus outbreak are eased.
I didn't mention the front of the Star. Maura and Curtis split up. Who is Curtis, or what's going on there?
You don't know who Curtis is?
I honestly don't. Like, why is this front of a paper? Seriously. There's a virus going on. Obviously, they've mentioned that, but like, who's Curtis?
I'm actually embarrassed for admitting that it's not the full newspaper. It is the biggest story in the world right now, Maura and Curtis breaking up.
Page three in the Star today.
It should be front and centre on every single newspaper.
What went wrong?
This is our royal couple, Johnny. I know you're not
the royal couple are actually in...
But this is the real royal couple.
But Star insists no hard feelings after breakup. So it's one of these breakups that, by all accounts, or at least Maura's, was amicable. Was it an amicable break?
It must have been. That's what they put it out on Instagram.
It's my turn with the papers, actually.
Okay, go for it.
Red Mist, Racing Post. Wounded Liverpool to take out their anger on Chelsea. Not sure about that now, to be honest. And the front, lost in translation, warming up for Gold Cup mission. Thankfully, we don't have anything too worrying about the coronavirus. Just business as usual. Odds of festival going ahead shortened following PM statement. Thank you, Boris.
The back page of the Sun is ready, steady goals, but Torreira KO, Mars win, and fan ban plan, Chiefs discuss behind closed door games. And that's basically, there's just one more there. You got the Herald.
Got the Herald, yeah. Strange enough headline from the Herald. Klopp, I'm not angry. We just weren't good enough, says Pool Boss. It's like, I'm not angry. I'm telling you, I'm definitely not angry. And the Six Nations gets the all clear. Desi suffers tunnel vision. Quite like that. Mm-hmm. What you make of the mass brawl? A bit of banter and Oma.
What can you make of it? Nothing is going to happen is another story that's doing the rounds this morning from that, because there's inconclusive evidence. But we will come back to that Klopp saying he's not angry story, because Phil Thompson, I'm delighted to say, is with us on the line. No, he's not. We will get back to him.
Get Tomo's view. I wonder, what odds Tomo knows what's going on with Maura, and what's his name?
Curtis. I would say there's a very small chance that he knows what the story is.
Was Maura on the Dancing on Ice?
She was.
So she was. She's been exposed to a British audience.
Yeah, she just needs to go on I'm a Celebrity now to complete the holy trinity of reality television shows.
Dancing on Ice, and it was, what was the first one?
Love Island. Her name, yeah. So,
An island to the ice.
Well, exactly. That's the headlines kind of write themselves this morning, but people would be delighted to hear that.
I want to know if Tomo knows breakup about this.
I'm not sure he does. Let's get to him. Phil Thompson, how are you?
Not too bad. It just went down my phone. I don't know what happened. What does Tomo want to know?
Does Tomo... So, we were just discussing this. Does Tomo know about Maura and Curtis splitting up in... do you know who Maura is, Tomo?
Lucas Maura.
That's fantastic.
I don't know too much outside the football.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
That's it. I think that's the only answer we needed to hear this morning, Phil.
Lucas Moura, denies having broken up with whoever his partner is.
Jurgen Klopp this morning, Phil, says he's not angry after the weekend. In fairness, Watford have said in the aftermath, Nigel Pearson said in the aftermath, that Liverpool handled us very well on Saturday night. They were very gracious in defeat. That does bode well for how Liverpool handled a setback, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does do. Listen, it's been a long, long time in the domestic league, the Premier League. And so, yes, it did hurt. I think because of the scoreline being 3 goals and us getting well beaten. I think that was the... It's annoying, but you have to be respectful. And I think that's where Jurgen Klopp has taken this Liverpool side. I think you have to move on. It's no good. You can't go into the dressing room and be angry with everybody. You just have to be calm. You have to point them in the right direction, because this team is a wonderful team. It's been going absolutely in this Premier League. It's been fantastic. So there's no need to panic.
What for you has happened with Liverpool since the winter break?
It was complacency for me. For me, I don't know what 2 weeks does for anybody. I think it takes the edge off a lot of players. I think there's a lot of teams in transition at the moment who need to keep at it rather than have a break, just change things. But I think it gives the teams in the bottom a little impetus. Get together, be angry, and give it a go. And you've seen some of the teams at the bottom who have probably been better than the teams at the top. But Liverpool, I think Jamie Carragher mentioned it on, I don't know whether it was this Monday or the Monday before, Liverpool have not reacted well when they've come off a break. I think it was last year when we went out to the FA Cup. We had a break, the players went away, they come back, took them quite a bit. I think we had a few draws. But I just think this side... Listen, after the Shrewsbury game, the first game, you could see the players who've been injured and who were coming need games. Now, I was surprised that they didn't play in the Shrewsbury replay. As you could see with Lovren the other day, yes, there was a lot of players who were as bad as him, but he was rusty. He didn't need a break. He needed football matches to get himself up to in tune with everybody. And I just think that is one of the things where I would rather the injured players trained and played in the Shrewsbury game and be ready.
It is a difficult one, because they've had a very, very demanding season, Phil. So it's kind of, you would think in theory a little break wouldn't do them any harm. But would it be possible to say that they didn't necessarily go into the break in unbelievably good form either? Like, I've been making the point for a while that they've kind of gotten through games this season where they haven't played that well. And even some of their league form, going back the last 6 weeks, like, they've kind of stumbled to a few victories. And maybe this was coming, that they were going to get one night where things just went wrong.
Well, I think a lot of Liverpool fans said that. Yes, I understand what you're saying. But at the same time, it doesn't matter. Throughout a campaign, you win games and you're not playing well. And that is the essence of a good side. People think back in my day that we were absolutely battered teams and we were wonderful every week. No, it wasn't. There was long periods where you went, you didn't play well, but you found a way. And that's what's been great about this side. It's nothing to knock at. But I would say since the break, the Norwich game, the West Ham game, you could see little sort of maybe problems coming in where we're not having enough chances. People didn't look sharp enough. There was too many. And us Liverpool fans were watching it. And we were going, probably the Watford game was coming. That sort of, not a defeat, not a 3-0. The defeat was coming round the corner. And yes, it's not very nice to take, but you just felt as though, yeah, get the monkey off our back, this thing. And all the going through it, unbeaten, invincibles and all this, yes, it'd be nice. It's not the essence. I just want this title, this Premier League title will be absolutely fine.
It's a slight double-edged sword tonight, isn't it? Because they obviously lost away to Atletico, so that's in the balance at the moment. They've lost their unbeaten record.
No, we will win that. We will win that.
Yeah, well, just say for example, okay, at the moment, anyway, I kind of expect them to win, but they've lost to Atletico. They've lost their unbeaten record in the league. So the Chelsea game tonight now is kind of... don't want to lose that game, but at the same time, if they're going into this game on the back of having beaten Atletico and beaten Watford, Liverpool fans wouldn't really care if all the kids played again as much, I think.
Yeah, and I get what you're saying, but I think I come back to it again now. These players need games. These ones who you could literally see. I go back to that Shrewsbury game, the first game. Some of the players who are coming back from injury were shocking, and I think. It's the same now today. We had a decent bench against Watford. There was a decent bench. There's a lot of players who need to play. And Keita might be back to play. So there's a lot of players who can still make up this side tonight. Don't put the kids out. Don't put the under-23s out. Because this is going to be a big game. It'll be interesting what Frank Lampard thinks of it and what Frank Lampard plays. Because he's as much... needing points in the Premier League to make sure they have Champions League football next year. So with Liverpool, though, I really think we'll have a decent team. But I don't think he'll put out the first team. But one of my biggest things is to have the cavalry on the bench if things are going wrong and you need a little bit of help. I think Curtis Jones will play. Neco Williams, who's been fantastic, he will play Larucci on the left-hand side. Have a mix of youngsters. And that's, I think, what Chelsea will be going at this game. They'll have ideas of this coming weekend as well in the Premier League.
Yeah, I think as well, the fact that Liverpool have only done a League Cup double once in their entire history, Phil. It's something to be chased after, regardless, even if they had hammered Atletico in the first leg, even if they'd won at the weekend. I still think the FA Cup represents a huge opportunity for this Liverpool team to go from one of the better Premier League teams we've ever seen to an all-time great English team because of the multiple trophies that they might win.
Not only that as well, Phil, but the Cup is kind of almost as much of a priority as the league now, because they've lost their unbeaten record. They're going to win the league, so they can win the Cup, so this should nearly be more important in some respects.
I would love to win the FA Cup. I still, it has always been one of the priorities. You always love it. I don't think these managers, these coaches, the way they see it, it's as important until they get to sort of maybe the quarterfinal stage or the semi-final stage. The same as the League Cup. It's always going to be difficult. You see Man City. Liverpool can't sort of change too many of the teams. You look at it, the forward line plays most weeks, the defensive line plays most all the time. So they need to sort of mix it up. Still, he has to realise this would be an absolutely wonderful thing on his CV. It's not going to be the be-all and end-all. The way they treat the FA Cup now is not the way they did in my day. And I love the FA Cup and I want to win that trophy. But I don't think it's going to change his stance on how he plays his teams unless he gets later on in the tournament. But this is a fantastic opportunity. Quarterfinals will be a one-off. If you get a nice home draw, that can really sort of set you up. I would love to go through with it. And as I say, don't have the kids on the bench. Have those first team players all ready to come on to give you a little bit of a push if you need it, that last 20 minutes, 25 minutes in the game.
And speaking of players that potentially could come back into the fold over the next little while, I think Jordan Henderson's absence has certainly made the heart grow fonder for a little bit if you're a Liverpool fan, I'd imagine, Phil. Him not being there has just kind of crystallised just how important he's been, almost as an icon for this team over the last few months.
Well, I was probably one of the first people pre-Christmas was championing him for being the player of the season. I know it was an early shout, but I did think he was having a massive impact. Kevin De Bruyne probably, as a footballer, is probably the best in the Premier League. But Jordan Henderson, for what he brings to this Liverpool team, and it's proven it since he's been out. He's a dynamic player. He's a very good player. He plays to his limits all the time. But it's what else he brings to this side, which what we've missed. If you look round, as I did, throughout the games that he's missed, there's nobody pointing fingers. There's nobody shouting and screaming, trying to get everybody G'd up. And that was what needed. It was so evident in the Watford game. Particularly go 1-0 down, it's regroup, get the boys together, punch a few fingers. Right? There was nothing like that. And I think Jordan Henderson has been missed massively just to cajole this team into another gear.
Why are you so confident they'll beat Atletico, actually, Phil?
I think the team's angry. I think the fans are angry. Some of the things what went on in that football match, you have to be a footballer when you're on that pitch. I remember screaming at Jamie Carragher in a game, and I was absolutely, because he hadn't put a tackles in and everything, and he just shouted back at me. He said, "Tommy, you don't realise." He said, "You blow on these lads and they fall over." He said, "You go near them." He said, I'll be getting." And I thought, "You're right." So this is a game goes on, and some of the tactics and some of the things they were doing, they pushed the limits. They went across that line. And you feel that as a footballer, it makes you angry. All the things, what was going on, Simeone with the crowd doing that. Yeah, the crowd were fantastic, and that feels like that. But this, they went over the line, and I think that's what. And this team, when they're angry, we've seen what can happen. And I just think Atletico not a Barcelona, and they're not a Bayern Munich, and I think Liverpool will beat them.
That's going to be some atmosphere, right?
Absolutely. Who was the team that Jamie Carragher was breathing on players and then falling down?
I can't remember which game it was, but we were having a sort of, and this was just at half time, and he was so anxious, and he was right. And I put myself in his position, and I thought, and what happens, you don't want to tackle, because you know they'll throw themselves to the floor, they took a bang on the head, but they'll hold their ankle. And they'll be rolling around. You'll be going, what's going on here? You jump up in the air to go for a header. They hold the face. They roll around on the floor. They remonstrate with the linesman, the referee, everybody. And the game just goes out of control.
That's what
makes
that
happening in that Atletico game. And I was watching it, and I was as angry and frustrated as the players were. And I thought, at 1-0, and I said on soccer, that was a good result. To come away and the players not go and chase the game, which they could have done, and it could have been even worse.
I'm really looking forward to that. I'm in Cheltenham, obviously, for that game.
I am.
The Tuesday night, Tom, to be at that game, I think the atmosphere will be... It'll be an Anfield on a Champions League night, but it'll be an angry Anfield as well, which is going to make it... And Simeone will try to fight his own corner. I think it's going to be utterly compelling.
Yeah, it certainly will.
I think it's all... Jürgen Klopp has called for their call to arms for the fans, and he knows what it was, but he tried to keep a lid on it. But he knows, you watching his press conferences, he will ask the fans to do their part.
Listen, Phil Thompson, enjoy the game tonight. Thanks for taking the call.
My pleasure. Cheers, guys. Take care.
Phil Thompson there on the line. Chelsea against Liverpool tonight in the FA Cup. Right, all this week we're chatting about the 20 by 20 movement, of which Off The Ball is a proud partner. We're asking everybody to show your stripes for women in sport by pledging one small action to either participate or play more, to attend more women's sporting events, or to promote, discuss, like, share and follow more female athletes. The effect of everybody's support will leave a legacy in Ireland and spearhead a shift in our culture. Find out more at 20by20.ie or post your pledge online using the hashtag #ShowYourStripes.
People always talk about having a son so that you can be interested in sport.
I play for Ireland and they're like, oh, anyone could get onto that. I could get onto that. It's just because these are girls. Like, it's so much easier.
When I was a young man, I didn't really think about that. Sport was just men's sport.
I ended up dropping sports, which has always been a huge regret of mine.
It's not that it's fed into you. You just hear it and you just believe it, really, as children, because you don't know any difference, you know.
You know, playing, I don't know, a match down in our local field where there's two people coming to it. Like, it didn't add up for me.
Because that's the way everybody thought.
Find something else, and I was like, no, I want to play football, like, I want to do this. I like caught the ball in my foot and like kicked it up and I like, caught it and I sprinted and I felt like Usain Bolt.
You always felt you were needed and felt part of something.
I like to think that it probably would have helped with friendships, it would have helped with confidence if I'd just been able to see that at the time.
Like, I feel sorry for any other girl that doesn't get the opportunity to play, because it's honestly something that every person should get to experience.
I mean, I think it underpins a happy life.
Such a positive thing in my life, and I just kind of wonder if I started it earlier, would I have been better now, or would I have been in a different place now?
Well, I think we understand now that we've like underinvested.
There is a period of time where it just wasn't part of my thinking either to say I should go, I should read, I should watch, but I should have, yeah. So
top five stories this morning on OTB AM. FA Cup is story number one. Arsenal 2-0 winners at Portsmouth last night. And of course, the big one tonight, Chelsea against Liverpool. Coronavirus fears, meanwhile, the Slovakia game could be played behind closed doors. A big meeting of the IOC then this morning about the future of the Tokyo Olympics. A few people concerned about that. Six Nations going ahead as planned for now. France, of course, banned gatherings of over 5,000 people, but that was just for closed scenarios, indoor arenas, basically. So hopefully in Saint-Denis that should go ahead. Gerry Thornley in the Irish Times this morning wondering if Leinster versus Saracens could potentially be under threat at Cheltenham, an insistence that it will go ahead as planned, and then the Premier League could potentially hold games behind closed doors. So that's very quickly the new coronavirus stories that we've got in sport this morning. Irish women lose, so they're obviously up against Greece this week. It's a European qualifier. We've got Katie McCabe in conversation with Shane Hannan later on. Dan Toohey was chatting to Joe last night, a fascinating interview about his time in the Ireland setup, his injury, and why he called it quits as a professional rugby player. And we'll start here with story number five, player welfare, Johnny, because this comes off the back of the Galway United story. For anybody who hasn't seen this, This is a fairly worrying story that came out yesterday about a couple of players who had hypothermia and one who had frostbite.
Yeah, it was Jack Lynch, who would be the Galway United right back. He tweeted on the bus back on Saturday evening that he said some 7 or 8 of the players had hypothermia. And one of the players, Killian Bruder, was taken off at half time by Alan Murphy. I think he more or less said that his body was effectively blue. Now, in hindsight, the game probably should have been called off there and then. I think Alan Murphy had both his centre backs, Josh, I forget his second name, the American centre back, he was injured, and Killian Bruder was obviously suffering from hypothermia. So Alan Murphy had all this crap to deal with at half time, and the referee decided obviously that the game was still okay to go ahead, but during the game the wind was really bad, and like there were several like corners and free kicks where the player couldn't keep the ball grounded. And you know, after the game anyway, one of the Shamrock Rovers players was brought to hospital for frostbite, and I think 9 of the Galway United players had hypothermia or symptoms of it. 2 of them weren't able to train last night as precaution. And, you know, the PFAI got involved yesterday and looked into why the game went ahead. But I think I'd have sympathy for the people involved, because the temperature wasn't extremely low, but there was obviously a wind chill that was shocking. I've never been at a game at any level in any sport where literally the second the final whistle went, the players just darted for the dressing room. Like, they didn't look at each other. And I was looking, God, this must be really, really bad.
They knew they were in a bit of trouble.
They knew, like, they were... So a load of the Galway United players apparently just threw up after the game. And by all accounts, one person described the Shamrock Rovers medics room like a scene from World War II. And the Shamrock Rovers medics were absolutely exemplary towards Galway United. And there's a strange irony here in that Shamrock Rovers' second team coming into the league has been absolutely derided by a lot of first division clubs who, in my view, have embarrassed themselves, because Shamrock Rovers had a good team out last Saturday, played in a great stadium, but also the Shamrock Rovers medics, they really looked after the Galway United players, and I think that'll put an end to any animosity towards Shamrock Rovers B, at least this season, because
they didn't care about that and the stupid attitude towards them coming into the league in the first place. They looked after the Galway United players, but it shouldn't have happened, and the players shouldn't be. I spoke to Jack Lynch yesterday. He said he was still shivering. This is on Monday, and it wasn't a good situation for those players to be in. And I'd extend that to say the game in Omagh should never have gone ahead on Saturday evening. I mean, I spoke to one player who said he's never played in worse conditions. I mean, we obviously had that shot by Dean Rock that ended up in Fermanagh or wherever it was. I mean, once that shot was taken, the referee should there and then say, this game should be called off. How can you play a game of football where the ball is so erratic as to basically move like 50 yards away from where it was supposed to be? And, you know, I really question that. There's a fixture schedule, there are TV issues and so on and so forth. I'm not suggesting the referee had that in his head, but there has to be a time when you say this game shouldn't be going ahead because it's an affront to the game itself. The Galway United Shamrock Rovers game was a deplorable game to watch. I mean, it was like a war, and it was a question of who could survive, but it wasn't football. I mean, Shamrock Rovers got a goal where the goalie just flapped at it because he probably couldn't really see the ball. Mm. And, like, are you telling me that Tyrone and Dublin, you know, the league has produced some fantastic games, mainly involving Dublin so far on live TV. Are you telling me that game should have gone ahead? I mean, what's the point? Like that's not football. Mm. And there is player welfare should be at the heart of it. And I was encouraged that the PFAI got involved in the Galway United situation because the players shouldn't be subjected to that. Now, at the same time, the officials had to deal with it as well. I was told by one of the officials that they were fine after the game, but I remember going into the ground and I was practically blown across the road, and I was like, how is this going ahead? But it did.
Yeah, like the goalkeeper, I'd imagine, is one of the more perilous positions on a night like that when you're just stationary for a lot of it. Probably doing laps around their box to keep themselves warm.
And Kevin Horgan, the goalie for Galway United, he made a bad mistake for the goal. But at the same time, I mean, I'm not even sure what he saw. But towards the end of the game, I was observing him and his ability and his attempts to keep warm. But this was a real storm. I mean, you've seen footage of the lorry and man crossing Galway just being blown off the road whilst driving around a bend. And this was sport is sport. There have to be times where, you know, fans should be subjected to a game that actually means something. This was a horrible game, and it didn't help Galway United either, because a game that they kind of needed to win to get off to a good start was rendered sort of just a war. And but 9 players suffering from hypothermia, I mean, I think next time there's a storm, don't play football.
Yeah, absolutely. But the players are okay now.
Well, two of them didn't train last night, so I'm only speculating. I didn't really know. I thought hypothermia was something you got when, like, you jumped into, you know, a lake in the middle of winter or whatever and stayed in the water too long. But, you know, obviously there's more to it than that. I think it's when your core temperature dips below, is it 35 degrees or something like that. But the Galway United players were well below it, and players vomiting on the bus on the way home. You know, it was a sorry situation for players who are, you know, effectively on not much money and, you know, battling in the first division of football in Ireland. That game, it would have been very easy to reschedule that game.
Yeah, we've already brought you the coronavirus updates. We've spoken about the hypothermia and player welfare there. We'll get to Dan Toohey's story a little bit later on, and the FA Cup as well. Our final story we're just going to touch on in this section of the show is Thursday night's Euro qualifier against Greece. Here is Shane Hannan in conversation with the Republic of Ireland's Katie McCabe.
All right, I'm here in Johnstown Estate in Enfield in County Meath, ahead of the Women's Euro 2021 qualifier against Greece. That's at Talla Stadium this coming Thursday. Not many tickets left, and then Montenegro next Wednesday night in the qualifiers. Katie McCabe of Arsenal and the Republic of Ireland has joined me. Katie, it's a busy week. 2 wins and a draw from the qualifying group so far, and I guess the draw against Greece towards the end of last year was a little disappointing, given it was such a late equaliser. But things are looking okay in Group I so far for the Irish team.
Yeah, no, definitely. Obviously, we started off the campaign really well with the 2 wins, and we were very frustrated over in Greece to concede the late equaliser. But look, now we're really looking forward to Thursday night, and it's been great being back in with the girls. But yeah, no, we're really, really looking forward to it.
There were a lot of injuries. I think Megan Connolly's back from the Greece game towards the end of last year, so a lot of girls returning as well. Leanne Jarrett is in serious form. Rhianna Gerard is in serious form, and a lot of competition for places at the moment as well. So they're all big pluses for Vera Powell, and she has a bit of a selection headache, which is something that probably wasn't the case even 3 or 4 years ago in this team.
Yeah, no, definitely. As you said, all these headaches are good headaches to have. The quality of players we have at the minute is fantastic to see. Obviously, as you mentioned, Rhianna flying, scoring 2 goals in her debut. We actually told her to stop scoring and to save them for Thursday night. But no, it's great to see the girls doing really well, and to have the squad go from strength to strength is fantastic, and only brings us confidence now into Thursday.
You were in action at the weekend in the Women's Continental League Cup final as well. Sorry to bring it up. Obviously, Chelsea winning 2-1 against your Arsenal side. But games like that, obviously disappointing in the result, but another big crowd, I think it was 6,000 maybe in attendance. So yourself and Louise Quinn are quite used to playing in front of crowds of this size.
Yeah, no, obviously it was a disappointing result for us on Saturday, but playing in front of those crowds, that's why we play the game. We want to be playing in front of 5,000, 6,000, even more than that, 1,000 crowds. And now it's obviously a massive thing for us, especially within the Ireland setup here. We know how important them supporters are to come to Talla Stadium and support us. And in the past results, even the Ukraine game, I know for a fact they got us over the line in that game and made us get the 3 points. They drove us on, spurred us on, and I'm hoping that they do the same now on Thursday night.
You've probably noticed yourself an increase in the Women's Super League in interest, in revenue, in various things. I know Manchester United and Tottenham have come on board as well with teams. How has the league improved, in your view, in the last 2-3 years? Have you noticed a change in attendance, a change in interest, a change in focus, and even young girls getting involved in watching football in the Women's Super League?
Yeah, no, absolutely. As you said, the crowds are growing. I know when I first came to Arsenal four and a half years ago, we didn't have the crowds we do now, and it's with investment and with social media, TV, BT coming on board, showing our games, BBC broadcasting live. All that helps towards it, and obviously it's down to us down on the pitch to produce and show people that we can play really good football and play really interesting styles of football. So I'm hoping to see it grow even more. Obviously Barclays have come on board to sponsor our league, and that's a massive statement in itself. So it goes to show we're going in the right direction, and hopefully it continues.
It's an interesting dynamic for you in this Irish team, in that you're still quite young for a footballer, but
I'll take that.
Yeah, quite young for a footballer, but you've been a captain. You know, Colin Bell made you captain, I think, in 2017. So you're still one of the more experienced members of this team. So is that something you enjoy, that when you come together in this Irish squad, that you're one of the leaders, and I guess the people that the younger players look up to and go to for advice?
No, of course. Obviously, I was made captain at a young age. But I think if I didn't have those really experienced players to help me and to guide me, I wouldn't be where I am today. Obviously, there comes difficult times, the easier times, but through those difficult times, the support I've had from my teammates, friends, family have been fantastic. And for me, what's important is to not just lead off the pitch, but to lead on the pitch and produce and help score goals and help us win games. And that's my main concentration. Obviously, it's great that we've got such a dynamic squad now, and we are going from strength to strength, and it's a really exciting time for us.
Yeah, Katie McCabe in conversation with Shane Hannan there yesterday ahead of the Republic of Ireland's Euro qualifier against Greece on Thursday night. Delighted to say now that we've got UCD Professor Paul Rouse with us in studio. How are you, Paul?
Very good, Owen, thanks.
So we wanted to chat about the potential of a Six Nations paywall with you, because it's something that you've written about and spoken about in great depth before across a whole range of sports. So for anybody who's missed this story, Six Nations are basically open to putting their competition behind a paywall. Sky Sports, Amazon this morning, supposedly interested in buying those rights. So you had a good piece on historyhub.ie a few years back, which is the UCD website on history.
Yes, the School of History and UCD's output, which it includes papers about what's happening around the world, but it also has podcasts. So if people are interested in podcasts about the Irish Revolution or on all aspects of history, it's there on that.
Because I hadn't seen this piece before, and basically you break down the figures as to why, when something goes behind a paywall, the obviously figures naturally drop, but also the interest in the sport potentially wanes with it as well. I presume those concerns definitely pertain to the current Six Nations question.
Well, the logical extension of what happens in a professional sport is that the administrators ultimately put their games behind a paywall. because it is behind a paywall that they received the largest payment from a broadcasting corporation. That's just a simple fact. Pay TV companies crave exclusivity, and exclusivity costs money. And of course, to pay the kind of figures that a pay TV company pays, as in Sky Sports or whichever one you want to pick, ESPN around the world, they must then charge large subscription fees to customers. And that's how it works. The customer essentially pays the TV company, who then pays the sporting organisation. It's the logical extension of professional sports.
Why does this matter for people, for the sport, and for, I guess, the interest in rugby? If you take this in isolation of the Six Nations, first of all.
I think most people around Ireland who are interested in rugby, if they're not from a rugby household, their access to the sport comes from watching Ireland in the Six Nations. Certainly anybody who's my generation, but even cascading back down through the generations, the first time they see a rugby match is often, or their first memory of rugby is often, Ireland playing on things. And this can spark an interest in people who would not ordinarily be interested in the game. And it is basically an entry point into a sport. It is always the case, or almost always the case, that providing they have money, people who are diehard supporters of a sport or who are interested in a sport will find it on a pay TV channel. What being on free-to-air gives you access to is a huge hinterland of casual interest. Hmm. And the numbers of this are absolutely clear, and they are repeated on sport after sport. You look what has happened to snooker. You look what has happened to rugby league. Look at what has happened to Formula One racing. Look at what happens to GAA matches when they're put behind a paywall. Viewership collapses, and collapses to about one-sixth of what it was in certain instances, and worse in many others.
Mm. That hinterland of casual interest, how important is that for a sport?
Well, how many players... It's extremely important for a sport because it sparks an interest in people who don't otherwise see a game. Now, it's not enough to say casual interest means more players in a sport. It's more complicated than that. There needs to be a structure. There needs to be a place for people to go to. There needs to be access in schools. All of these things. All of these things matter. But if we argue that the profile of a sport matters, and every single sports administrator understands immediately that the profile of their sport matters in terms of drawing sponsorship, in terms of drawing wider interest, in terms of identification on a local level with a game. Every sports administrator understands that. So if you lessen profile, which you inevitably do by putting the games behind a paywall, mm-hmm. that has to have a repercussion of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Where is this going to go in terms of streaming and all that? Because, yeah. you know, people's means of... When racing in Ireland went to racing TV, and that's like... It's in theory, it's about 30 quid a month, but you can get better deals. But I kind of defended this deal on the basis that most people are not watching racing on their TV. They're watching it on their phone, effectively, or their laptop. So where is this going, for example, for future deals? Because so many people are legally streaming now as well and aren't really watching on TV necessarily anyway. So how is this going to change the landscape, I suppose?
Well, I suppose there's different levels of looking at this. There are the repeated games of rugby, just as are the repeated horse races around the country on any given day, where it's a constant churn of an industry. So the broad, massive populace aren't going to follow that anyway. But then there are iconic moments in the sport. So there is, for example, there's Cheltenham, or there's the Irish Derby, or the Grand Irish Grand National, or the Grand National. If they're behind a paywall, that changes casual interest in it straight away. Equally, the vast bulk of rugby matches that are played around the country, nobody's any interest really in watching them. Mm. But people do want to see Ireland play England in the Six Nations. So there are different levels within a sport as to what you wish to do. And I think that really matters. And it's fine saying people don't watch telly anymore or people don't stream anymore, but all the stats tell you the opposite. The stats are really clear on this. Most people still watch telly. most people still watch sport on television, and certainly any sort of big moment, they don't want to be stuck watching it on their phone. The phone is a matter of convenience when you're doing something else, or you're watching on a laptop when you're doing something else, or people cast from their phone or their iPad onto a telly, so it can be a means of access. But the question you ask about streaming is really, really important, because there is a streaming revolution underway at the moment which is transforming how people watch sport. So for example, the NBA app, if you like basketball, I love basketball, you can, for $200 in any given year, you can watch every single basketball match played in the NBA and stream it if you wish. So that means you're not reliant on the choice of broadcasters. It means that if I want to watch the Boston Celtics, or if I want to watch the LA Lakers and I want to just watch them, that's fine. So this is changing things, number one. Number two is changing things because if you look at rugby administrators, I think, or sports administrators, I think they have TV marketing in kind of a sweet spot at the moment, because you do have the terrestrial TV companies who really want it but are in an awful lot of bother financially. You have the big subscription TV companies who are sports companies who are now having to pay huge sums of money to hold on to rights which they are trying to protect from Amazon or from whichever streaming company now wants them. So there's a real, it's a real dogfight now for access. And ultimately there are then the sports organisations who are trying to maintain this means of production for themselves so that they can sell it. So the NBA do it, the NFL do it, and baseball in America do it. They all have their apps and they sell these sports around the world.
Funny enough, that's what I kind of envisage as being the future, in that like the NBA will basically, you pay the NBA to watch it, or you pay the clubs, and it'll be all kind of like subscription based online services, and that'll be streamed onto the TV effectively. But I don't think that's that far away.
Can we talk about like the specific case of rugby here, actually, just because like you've written in this piece that I mentioned there about Heineken Cup viewing figures. Obviously, they go off a cliff when it goes to Sky Sports. The interest, I would say, waned significantly amongst the casual fan once the Heineken Cup went behind
a paywall. Well, we know as a fact it did.
It did, yeah.
We know from the stats. I mean, there's a really clear study the first year it went from RTE to Sky Sports. You can track exactly the difference of what happened. Leinster played a quarter final on a Saturday in 2006, the last year in which it was live on RTE, and the following year they played another quarter final on a Saturday, both games away, both games on a Saturday, and you can track exactly what happened. On RTE on a Saturday afternoon, there were 255,000 people watching Leinster play rugby. On Sky there were 47,000. Now that is an absolute collapse, no matter what way you dress it up, but it's a really specific collapse as well. So kids under 14, that target audience of people who you want to get into the game, minimum of 27,000 watching on RTE, 2,000 on Sky, and so on across the board. Now you can say, okay, that's 15 years ago, things have totally changed. They haven't totally changed.
And many people watch that in the bar then? Do you know how many? Can you quantify that?
Yes, so you can. Many people, so what happens? So what happens is, and this is really interesting, the number of people who then go, there's a study done after that, and the number of people who then go to the pub to watch these games increases by 2 or 3 times. Mm-hmm. So it either doubles or trebles, including the number of kids who go to the games. So in a society where we're supposed to be moving towards reducing alcohol
reliance
use,
or whatever,
reliance
yeah.
on kids, and let's not be po-faced or pious here. People love going to bars to watch matches. I love going to a bar to watch a match myself. It's great fun. But can we really argue that it's a place for a 12-year-old?
Right, it is 8.33 on the Tuesday morning. You're watching or listening to OTBAM. Just to let you know, we've got a WhatsApp number now as well. You can comment via that. You can get in touch using 087 9180 180. That's 087 9180 180 if you want to leave a comment. We'll be back in a moment.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. American Football 101 on Off the Ball.
With the Aer Lingus College Football Classic.
Known by many as the winningest team in college football history, the Michigan Wolverines are an iconic football program. Home to the second largest stadium in the world, known as the Big House. It has a capacity of 107,601, but it has hosted crowds of over 115,000. Michigan has won the national championship 11 times, with their most recent win coming in 1997 under coach Lloyd Carr.
American Football 101 on Off the Ball.
With the Aer Lingus College Football Classic.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Okay, UCD Professor Paul Rouse is still with us in studio. we were chatting about rugby in particular here, and the reason why I think rugby actually might be a little bit more in danger than other sports is not just because it's on the periphery worldwide, I guess, but also because of like new research done into the dangers of the game sometimes. Like you talk about appealing to youngsters of Ireland, there's also a bit of a battle to win the hearts and minds of parents who actually want to send their kids into rugby as well, from casual backgrounds, from not rugby playing families, for example, which I think may actually hammer home the importance of this particular deal.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure on it. I think it's a tricky thing for every sport to work out where to put its games. And you can see the logic if you're a rugby administrator and you've the equation. If I leave these games on free-to-air, I get 70 million. If I sell them to Sky Sports, I get 300 million.
And it depends what you do with that money then.
It is absolutely what you do with that money. So that's the tricky equation. And the logic of professional sports is you take the 300 million. Isn't that right? Mm. The logic of it is, in the short term, but how you use the money then is really important for the longer term. What you intend to do with it really matters for the longer term. For professional sports, which doesn't make claims about community development and all of these things, that is the logic. We need to pay our players, we need to develop our stadium, we need to improve our product. That is essentially the thing. But they're not the only people who are stakeholders in this game. Society has a stake in what happens to a sport. The government has a stake in what happens to a sport. There's an EU directive from 1997 which led the Irish government in 2003 to put in place a list of sporting events which must appear live on free-to-air telly. So there are things like the All-Ireland football and hurling finals. There's the Rugby World Cup, Ireland's matches in the Rugby World Cup. There is all matches in the Soccer World Cup and all Ireland's qualifying matches in the Soccer World Cup. And the Nations Cup in the show jumping in the RDS, the Irish Grand National and the Irish Derby. So that's basically...
The Summer Olympics.
So they're the games that are on an A list, which means they must appear there. On the B list is one event, and that is the Rugby Six Nations Championship. And the reason why it's on the B list is a magnificent lobbying job done by the rugby authorities, who's basically said, we need to not put these games on that list, because we need to keep the sports broadcasters honest in what they're bidding and drive up the fees.
So explain that then. So this is around 2010, Eamon Ryan is Minister for Communications.
This is before 2010. This is 2003. Okay. So in 2010, Eamon Ryan, who was Minister for Communications, leader of the Green Party, came in with this proposal in 2010, 7 years after the list was created, and said, this list is absurd. The idea that a Six Nations of a rugby match is not as important as a soccer qualifier where Ireland play Azerbaijan or something like that is a nonsense. It is a major sporting event and it should be on the list. Equally, the GAA All-Ireland semi-finals and quarter-finals and provincial finals should all be on this list. Now, in response to this, the Cheltenham Festival. Mm. So in response to this list, the GAA and especially the IRFU launched a huge lobbying campaign. The GAA said, no need for us to go on this list, we'd never sell our games to Sky anyway. Well, that went well. So they managed to stay off the list. And the Irish Rugby Football Union, basically joined, by the way, it should be said, by the rugby correspondents on Ireland's national newspapers, etc., just drove this campaign where they basically pilloried the idea.
Why were they singing from that same hymn sheet?
Because they bought the line that we need this. Like, I mean, rugby journalists, I mean, they're an extraordinary bunch. It seems to me there are brilliant journalists there, absolutely brilliant journalists. But
they sing from the party line, or?
Well, in this, I have to be really, really careful here what you say, but some certainly just took the party line and run with it.
Yeah, you're not tarring everyone with the one brush.
Absolutely not. 100% not tarring everybody with the one brush. But in this,
it's interesting. Eh?
It was really. You should go back and read the columns on it from 2010. But something else happened. Simon Coveney, who was then in opposition for Fine Gael, he had argued vehemently against, or he condemned the government, Fianna Fáil PD government of 2003, for not creating a list. Because in 2002, what happened is, after 2002 in Saipan, the Football Association of Ireland had sold their games to Sky Sports. So there was a huge public outcry, and Coveney was one of those people who said it was absolutely wrong, and the government was wrong not to have put these games on a list, and therefore they were sold. Fast forward to 2010, Coveney said, this is ridiculous. How can you do this to the IRFU? If you put them in penury, you're totally wrong. So there's a whole show going home. There's rugby journalists, there's politicians, and the
sporting body itself.
Sporting body itself. And they basically ran this whole thing into the sand. And then the government fell, of course, undone by a crisis of epic proportions, which made a dispute over Sky Sports look quite small, to be fair.
Thank God for the recession.
By the way, I don't argue that those rugby journalists didn't believe what they were saying. I don't argue that at all. They may have absolutely 100% believed what they were saying, but I really question whether they thought through their positions on it. And I really question what they will write when these games are sold, if they are sold to Sky Sports. Now, the vindication for their position is very simple. And the vindication for the IRFU's position is very simple. That what they're doing here is trying to frighten the horses, frighten the BBC, frighten ITN, frighten RT or Virgin Media, whatever collection of those you wish to see, frighten the French station and say, look, we're about to sell these games to Sky Sports. You need to give us another 30 million or 40 million.
So it's a win-win.
So they could just be trying to drive up the price.
It's fascinating to track the Premier League from when it became the Premier League and it went to Sky. If you ask sort of the working class fans of English football now, which would they prefer, those who remember the old days? Now, there might be this kind of, I remember the communist days and, you know, dewy-eyed, and obviously it was a lot worse, but a lot of people would say it was in a much better place because it was affordable and it was a working class game, whereas now you go to a Liverpool game and it's 50-50 probably people are... Not from Liverpool, not even English.
Yeah. It's a global sport.
It's incredibly expensive. To watch it, you have to obviously subscribe to BT or Sky or whatever it is. And it's a qualified success in terms of the behemoth that it's become. And that's where pay-per-view is become. It's a little bit of it's a thorny subject for me anyway.
I agree.
Yeah, like I think the point about football, if we're talking about participation here, and I know it's not something that you can ever put a concrete figure on in terms of correlating it, but football is probably going to be too big to fail in any respect. Like rugby, I think Ryan Nugent was on the pay-per-view about a month or two back, and he was saying that it will go back to being on the periphery if it goes behind a paywall, if the Six Nations goes behind a paywall. And I guess one of the better comparisons you can make is with cricket, and that's obviously covered in your History Hub piece as well. Just to read just a quick section from this about the ECB and their attitude to selling to Sky Sports, which of course happened around the turn of the century. The attitude of the ECB in agreeing to the deal was epitomised by one of its members, the chairman of Durham County Cricket Board, Clive Leach. He said, "There will always be people in certain walks of life who cannot afford things. That's the way it will be." This sort of
extraordinary, actually.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
This sort of
it's extraordinary, but it's how people feel. Like, and let's be absolutely clear about this. That was the logic of the GAA's decision to put their games behind a paywall in the middle of the worst recession in modern Irish history in 2010. That was the logic of it. The economy has fallen off a cliff, and the GAA put its games some of its most important games behind a paywall.
And then they will argue that was the reason why they did that very thing, because their coffers might not have been in the best position themselves.
And they also, by the way, increased ticket prices at the time. So they did two things to protect themselves. They can argue all they want that they did it to protect the organisation. But the logic of that position is, well, if you can afford to pay it, it's no bother to you. Yeah. If you can't afford to pay it, well, so what?
My point here is that this ECB situation is a bit of a warning sign, and we don't necessarily have to view rugby into the future, even behind a paywall, as going the same way as cricket. If that attitude prevails in rugby, then the sport might be doomed, but I'd like to think that perhaps the IRFU in particular wouldn't go down that route, that actually they would accept that this money that would be brought in as a result of a huge pay-per-view package would actually go back into the grassroots, would go back into ensuring that rugby still is prominent in Irish society.
Well, yes, but that's setting up a binary where it's either or. Like, what you do with your money is your decision. It is true. But you must plan both short-term and long-term. You plan too much of a long-term in sport. The short-term ends up being a disaster and you can't compete.
That's fascinating. You will have seen from, I know you said you don't go to Congress, you will have seen the weekend there were figures in relation to the county board spend versus yeah. the spend on the grassroots, and it's actually shocking. Like, yeah. it's a keeping up with the Joneses, whereas, so if Offaly are doing it, Laois have to do it or whatever, but basically throwing money at the elite, whatever it is, 0.1% at the behest of...
Well, the Laois lads always follow us. Yeah, that's kind of normal.
Like, it's so
they're living in the shadow of a superior civilization.
They are. Some of whom I met at the weekend, Tom Malone in particular, at a Ballinasloe Freeview night. But like, you can't just trust that the money will be spent properly. And if you're going into the elitist kind of area, then I think you're going down a dodgy road.
I agree with that. And the race to the idea, this is what happens in an industry. People find new ways in every industry to make money, and you drive, you make yourself relevant. Making money in an industry, you do that by making yourself relevant within that industry, and you wrap everything gets wrapped around that, and it becomes a snowball effect, and the sport demands more money at every opportunity. But there's a cautionary tale here for people who plough all their money into one area of it as against another, and it's Irish soccer, domestic soccer in the 50s and 60s, and look what happened. Look at the amount of money that flowed into the game from huge crowds appearing everywhere, and where did it go?
Wasted.
So just to sum up, Paul, before we let you go, because I know you need to run, you sound a little bit more positive about this than, say, the GAA going behind.
The GAA is an amateur sporting organisation, which is supposedly community based, which is supposed to be accessed to all. So the logic of the GAA is
completely different. It's an entirely
different argument, in my view.
But at the same time, you would have reservations about putting this behind a paywall, but only if the money is spent incorrectly. Whereas, actually, if the IRFU
I'm selfish here. I want to not have to pay for these games. I want to be able to watch them. I think in the broader fabric of sport in the country, it is better if there are more games. The desire of people to exercise their freedom by paying more money for something amuses me. I think the idea that this is somehow something that it's an act of freedom that does down RTE or TV or Virgin Media or whoever would give the games to Sky. Well, do you really want to pay for it? Like, is the idea that you should do that? And let's be clear about this. This is not the IRFU. It is not Sky Sports giving the IRFU or whatever pay TV company giving the IRFU a whole lot of money. This is the subscriber. Mm-hmm. Who pays their money, giving the IRFU or whoever lots more money.
Yeah, very true. Listen, Paul, always great to chat to you. Thanks a million for popping in this morning. We've got Tom Malone standing by to bring us up to speed on everything that's happening in the world of sport this morning. Before that, here is Dan Toohey, the recently retired rugby player who was chatting to Joe Malloy last night. Here's what he had to say about Joe Schmidt.
Joe knew the buttons to push on me to get me going, but he also, he may not have known that when he pushed certain buttons or didn't push them, he certainly knew how to break me, and it was a tough time for me at times with Joe. So I played some good rugby in and around the Irish squad and a few times for Joe, but I also played some of my worst rugby in Ireland jersey.
Right.
I can sit here and honestly say I probably came in a little bit overweight. I had a relaxing holiday with my family in the summer, so I was playing a little bit catch up. I had a little bit of an Achilles problem, so I couldn't do all of the training, and I missed out on the selection for the squad. Actually, I actually had a really good game off the bench against Wales, played really poorly against Scotland when I started at the Aviva, so I was told I was on reserve standby. So naturally, I'm watching the World Cup, you know, hoping I can do well, enthusiastically watching my friends Darren and Chris Henry that I was close with, and I saw Paul O'Connell get injured, for example, against that in that French game, which was ultimately the injury that finished him. And for the last number of weeks, I'd been telling everybody that I was on standby, and I was thinking, right, here comes the phone call, and then nothing come, and then one of the guys in camp texted me, said Mike McCarthy's just arrived, and I thought, Jesus Christ, and that really hit home hard, because I never got a phone call off anybody. And I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed in front of my missus, her family, my family, all my friends, my peers. I thought, I am just broken to the core, because that was everything for me. And then post that World Cup, and that was the last time I even represented Ireland. So, you know, I've partly to blame for that, but it was a tough time for me, I must admit.
Yeah, great stuff there with Dan Toohey on Off the Ball last night. The full piece available on youtube.com/Off the Ball. Tom Malone has joined us in studio. How are you, Tom?
Well, it's a sad day. Obviously, I'm
following the news about Moran Curtis, but you know, we'll soldier.
We have it here somewhere, actually, and we have it there.
It's okay, I know.
Moran Curtis split up, and you can go to page 3. I like the way Phil Thompson thought it was Lucas Moura.
Lucas Moura. That was
Moura from Longford.
True football.
Where did it go wrong with Moura and Curtis? What do you reckon? It was amicable.
It was amicable.
They're still mates.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I mean,
we can only speculate.
But the struggles, you know, maintaining a top level professional media career and a relationship, very difficult, as you well know, Johnny.
It's Curtis, I feel sorry for.
It's Curtis,
whoever he is. I genuinely have no idea.
Professional dancer, Curtis. Oh. He would rather make coffee for his housemates than snuggle in bed. I think that was his most famous contribution to Love Island last year.
He gets his comeuppance for what he did to Amy in the Love Island villa last night. I'm sure you'll agree, Johnny.
Who?
Yeah, I mean, she was going to tell him she loved her.
Is this still going on?
Jeremy Harper. It was last summer, but sure, how could you possibly forget?
How could you forget?
Tom, what's going on?
Let's start with Arsenal, who avoided a potential banana skin in the FA Cup fifth round last night. Mikel Arteta's side were 2-0 winners away to Portsmouth to secure a place, the first place in the quarterfinals. Greek defender Socrates scored the opening goal for the Premier League side, and he was glad to set up the side for victory.
Yeah, it was a good goal. It was a goal that gave us confidence and to be more calm in the game after, to control the game. And I think it was also an important moment for us. And it was a moment that gave us a lot of confidence for winning the game.
Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp, meanwhile, says their first Premier League defeat of the season away to Watford won't influence his team selection for tonight's FA Cup clash at Chelsea. Meanwhile, Newcastle face a tricky test away to Championship leaders West Brom, and Reading entertain Champions League hopefuls Sheffield United. Middlesbrough's winless run extended to 12 last night when they missed a chance to move out of the relegation zone in the Championship. They were held to a 2-2 draw by Nottingham Forest. Lewis Grabban's late equaliser there, securing a point for Forest. The Republic of Ireland will today discover their UEFA Nations League opponents in Amsterdam. Russia, Austria, Wales and the Czech Republic are League B's top seasonal potential opponents. What will then be, of course, Stephen Kenny's side. Also in Football Republic of Ireland star Áine Gorman said it felt right to come out of international retirement. The 30-year-old has returned to Virpao's squad ahead of this week's Euro 2021 qualifiers against Greece on Thursday and, of course, Montenegro next week as well. The Piemont United star said it's good to be back.
Really happy to be here. I think I've just slotted back in. It's like I never left, really, to be honest, and really looking forward to the games. Yeah, I think it just came about like a couple of weeks ago, and Vera gave me a call. Obviously, there's a few injuries in the squad or whatever, and obviously I was delighted to be called back into to the new setup as well. And I think I'd regret it if I didn't take up the opportunity.
Just on that, the Nations League draw, it's quite interesting that Daniel McDonald spoke about this in the Indo today, that Mick McCarthy has to go to the draw for games that he will not be taking part in. But then he did make the point, well, if Stephen Kenny went, that would also be a bit weird, but kind of they're compelled. I don't think Mick O'Neill is there though, because he's on Stoke duty, but seemingly kind of you are compelled to send your manager. Yeah. But Mick must be like absolutely relishing the prospect of people who don't know asking him, what do you make of the draw and what chance do you have? And saying, well, I actually won't be in the job.
Some like Europa or UEFA social media child who has to go and can do those interviews. Yeah.
This will be a formative day in his life as a young journalist. You know?
He gets his first Mick McCarthy stare.
Growl.
On to rugby. Munster hope to have a fit and healthy Joey Carberry back for pre-season training. The province last night confirmed that the fly half season is over after he underwent a second surgery on the ankle that he originally injured back in August. Carberry, of course, already sidelined by a wrist tendon injury that came in his only start for Munster back in December. Well, the Six Nations organisers say they intend to see this year's championship completed when time allows. They've confirmed that the tournament will proceed as normal despite fears over the coronavirus. Ireland's game with Italy, of course originally scheduled for this Saturday, remains the only one yet to be postponed because of the outbreak. Ireland, of course, due to travel to France on Saturday week, and tournament organisers concede that respective governments may take the decision out of their hands. Well, the NBA players have been told to avoid high-fiving fans and strangers, to avoid taking any item for autographs in the league's latest response to its ongoing monitoring of the coronavirus outbreak. The league sent a memo to teams on Sunday offering 10 recommendations to players with hopes of decreasing the risks to virus, including those not taking items such as pens, markers, balls, jerseys, and of course don't be giving high fives to randomers in the crowd as well. Penultimate story in boxing, Eddie Hearn says he's been in regular contact with Tyson Fury Series promoter Bob Arum about a potential heavyweight unification bout with Anthony Joshua. It was confirmed yesterday that Joshua will face Bulgarian Kubrat Pulev in the Tottenham Stadium on June 20th, while Deontay Wilder has triggered his rematch clause with Fury, but Hearn is hoping for a unification bout between Fury and Joshua in December. And finally, racing just a week to go, of course, until the Cheltenham Festival. Racing action this afternoon is the rescheduled meeting at Navan. First going to post there at 20-2.
Good stuff, Tom. Thanks for that. It is 8:55 on this Tuesday morning. You're watching OTB AM, and it is time to turn to Spanish football. Graham Hunter, a very good morning to you. So we'll talk El Clásico. I think it's the only place to start, really. Madrid's first win against Barcelona in the league since 2016. But if you look at it from the actual entertainment point of view, I think it was El Mundo who described the game as decrepit at one point. Gerard Piqué, who was kind of gracious in defeat but still admitted that it was the worst Real Madrid team that he's faced in recent times. It paints a picture that, sure, it's a great result for Real Madrid, but not exactly a great night for El Clásico.
Yeah, and you don't invite me on here to be a cheerleader for anything. And this made a pair. The 0-0 draw at the Camp Nou was technically better than this in terms of strategy, the way the individual players shone. In fact, probably better in terms of the quality of football overall, but no goals. This will be remembered because we got two goals, two strange goals. It was very important for Madrid not to go 5 points behind. But if you're bandying about quotes to me, then Jorge Valdano, not for the first time on, got it right in the lead up. He said, this is the meeting of two cojos, two sides that are lame. And we haven't got the time on the show nor on this slot to pin down all the things that ail Spain's two biggest teams, which nonetheless are still fighting a head-to-head battle for the title. With 12 matches remaining, none of the other teams are yet good enough to catch them. But particularly in the second half, we simply saw a Real Madrid able to win because, and these are not phrases that I've used with you on this show over the years, they won more 50-50 balls. They won second balls more often. They sprinted and ran past their man more often. I'd love to try to tell you that there was a massive surge in some sort of tactical master play in the second half from Zidane. There wasn't. It took him far, far, far too long to put anybody, it happened to be Mariano, born nearer the Camp Nou than any, well, the majority of the Barca players, on to against Jordi Alba, who was knackered, who'd come back early from hamstring problem, probably shouldn't have played. Kudos to him for saying, I'm up for it, but from about halftime onwards, Jordi Alba was knackered. Zidane could have put another striker on, played down Madrid's right, tested Alba, where the second killer goal finally came from with 90 minutes and added time. So what we watched was, again, a side that even though there's a tiny margin between them, a point at the moment, said to you over a few weeks now, I think Madrid will win the title. I think they are the better squad. The better 11. I think they're in better shape. Not by much, but I think they're champions elect. Nonetheless, we saw them winning a Clásico that I find it hard to remember, even going back 20 years, when it's been as two sides as in disarray as these two are at the moment, Owen.
Yeah, it seems that way. And obviously, you look at the performance of Lionel Messi on Sunday, and there has to be a few warning signs, I guess. Like, you can blame it on the way Barcelona play in terms of almost replicating Argentina at this point, just forcing the issue sometimes with Lionel Messi. That probably contributes hugely to how many times he lost possession over the course of the night. But then you had like someone like Marcelo celebrating his dispossession like it was a goal. You're shaking your head there, Graham.
I am, Owen, because, you know, it's our job, broadcasting, writing, to tell it as we see it, to take risks, to sometimes not deliberately seek opprobrium and clicks. That's nonsense. And my life is better because of Leo Messi, starting with being a lover of football, and he makes your heart sore. I don't care if you're Barcelona or Argentina or not. He's changed my professional career. It's been a privilege to be working and to be alive in the era of Leo Messi. But since November, I've been writing consistently, broadcasting, that Leo Messi is wildly off form for his standards. sometimes the goals keep coming. Last week against Eibar, he hit 4. The assists have flowed, and you can say because he's so extraordinary that he's still been head and shoulders above his teammates. But the things you picked up on, because you're astute, if you think about the number of times and the way in which the ball is lost, he always had a high percentage of losing possession because he's the guy who takes risks. He's the guy in the final sprint where the tackles come flying in, where teams mark him with 3 or 4 players, and yet on form he still gets away from them. Now these things you were highlighting, where the ball is given away needlessly, where he's tackled and he can't run after the player. For example, when Marcelo sprinted, you talked about when Messi was right through, I think from a De Jong pass, he'd been wildly offside, walked back, hit the line of offside, spiralled, and De Jong released him. At that point, Marcelo caught him easily. Now, Marcelo is leaner. Marcelo is in better physical shape than he's been for quite some time. But in the old days, that wouldn't have been a contest. And again, Messi choosing to go into little dark areas of the pitch when he's got the ball at his feet, that he would automatically, irrespective of his physical shape, his brain would have said to him, now release, play the wall pass, dribble left, not right. Since November, he has been repeatedly making these errors. Is it physical shape? Is it that he's just totally pissed off with what's going on around him, which looks very feasible the more that it carries on? But the more that teams block him and close him down, Napoli, are you listening? The more in which it's difficult for him to get by teams other than doing the things that make him a genius, the more he's begun to look like a player who's easily asphyxiated. And that's not a phrase that, even though he's 32, I expected to be using for another 3 or 4 years, Owen.
So it would have to concern you then about the immediate future of Lionel Messi's form. Of course, he's still going to continue to be an excellent player, possibly the best player in his team. Do you think he will return to the position of being the undisputed greatest in the world at a point? Like, you can debate about whether or not a player will reach a cliff or whether or not it'll be a slow decline. It may not happen for a few years yet. We would like to think that perhaps we're wrong about this, but one or the other is going to happen. What do you think it is going to be?
My best and most honest assessment is that he had a poor summer where, you know, excessive football and an injury combined to lose him a pre-season. He got injured again almost as soon as he came back. He then had, in the 5, 6, 7 weeks leading up to the awards, where he won both Best and Ballon d'Or, he was playing not only high goal football, but he was playing with electricity in his boots. It was tantalizing, it was brilliant. And then in this instance, the decline began to look slow, and then it kind of fell off a cliff in terms of individual form. The stats look good, because if he's given space, then fine. But in my honest opinion, it's a combination of the fact that physically he reached this season getting buffeted about by bad injuries, a calf problem that wouldn't go away. And he is looking around himself and saying, they promised me better players. They promised me a brand of football that suited me. I've lost Suarez, his best strike partner ever. We're not very good. His interview before the Napoli match said, if we don't stop committing little stupidities on the pitch, then we're not good enough to win the European Cup. My diagnosis is that both physical and mental right now, he's treading water. And therefore, back to be the outright best in the world, that's something only he can answer. But back to being completely different from this, yeah, I do fully expect that, yes.
I'm just interested, Graeme, in the general well-being of La Liga this season, because I've felt that the Premier League has kind of lacked proper depth, and the performances in Europe haven't been great in the last 16 rather. But I mean, you look at Barca and Real, Atletico, as much as they beat Liverpool, they're a fairly limited team. What sort of state is La Liga in at the moment,
Johnny? That's the one. Yeah, I'd love to be able to write a PhD thesis on that. If I'm honest, over and over again, there's been asset stripping from bigger clubs, whereby players are beginning to now leave at much younger ages. I think that La Liga has been not only extraordinarily healthy domestically for 2 decades, it's been utterly dominant in Europe. probably in club and European terms over the last 20 years, even if you include Germany or Brazil or Holland at their very best, in my opinion, this has been the most dominant combination of national and club football in the history of the European game. Does there inevitably have to be a decline when sometimes great thinkers, never mind the playing resources, but football directors or presidents or coaches, the jigsaw pieces that go together to make things exceptional, either decline or go away or retire or get sated? Is La Liga right now as powerful, as technically gifted as what, you know, you two have been used to me listing their benefits to you over 20 years? Johnny, no. I think that they're not far off, but is it five-star right now in many aspects, not just in terms of the way in which there's been a brain drain away from La Liga because there's bigger money elsewhere and outside the top two clubs, that's factually true, then I think there are difficulties. And what's more, the youth system keeps producing brilliant new talent. But my fear is, if that brilliant, it's just like fishing. If you don't let the stocks grow, then eventually you won't be able to have fish for your tea.
Can I ask you about Vinicius' performances at the weekend, Graham? It's been an interesting week for him, obviously missing a sitter against Manchester City midweek, possibly scapegoated. I'm not sure what the Madrid media was like in the aftermath of that game, to then scoring the winning goal at the weekend. Like, sometimes we have to just hold on for a moment and realise that he is only 19 years of age. So, like, I'm interested, like, what's been the biggest criticism of Vinicius up until this point? And is he going some distance to disproving his doubters so far this season?
Did you use that? Was that Freudian? Did you use that phrase, hold on a minute, because you saw my face getting ready to pounce? Right. When the ball came in against City, he probably lurches and he falls over, misses a chance. He did make the goal for Isco to go 1-0 sure. up in that very same game. And therein, in exactly that little, that jovial repartee between you and I, therein lies the debate about Vinicius, he's 19, mate. He's a guy for whom finishing is a lot more natural than he's making it look at Real Madrid. He scored 15 senior goals more quickly than Messi or Ronaldo, Cristiano Ronaldo did. At Flamengo, he played far more centrally. He played second striker. It was far easier for him, not being on the wing coming in, to be striking off either of his two feet when he finished. And in general, you know the answer to your own question. In general, there has been a degree, I think too much of a degree, of frustration about the fact that sometimes he seems to get a rush of blood to the head at Real Madrid. He used a really good phrase to help explain this. He said that one training session at Real Madrid is worth 10 games of experience in the Brazilian league. And that's quite a perspicacious self-assessment from a kid who at that stage was 18. At the moment, what I think is absolutely evident is that there's a gem here. It's not just that he's fast, although he is brutally fast. It's the fact that technically he is extremely gifted. He also has two things massively in his favour. He's extremely willing to learn. He wants to be taught. This is not some arrogant show off, I've got the ball, the crowd need to bill and coo at my ability. He wants to learn. And the second thing is, I've commentated at Bernabeu on Sunday night with Michael Laudrup. Now, Michael at 19 was a much better player than Vinicius is. But Michael picked out the fact, and I like that because it's something I've been proposing in writing on this medium too, that, you know, if you have ability and you try things, you will fail. And how do you react to that? When the crowd groans, when the media are on your back, as you pointed out, saying he can't finish, which is just monosodium glutamate to me. It's just like pigeonholing about, okay, but talk about the things he can do. When he fails, when things don't go right, industrial rubber confidence, back up, try it again, try something different, learn from the experience, but do it again. Don't hide, don't shrivel. You know, in all the sports you cover, Johnny and Jer, there are players who, when the pressure's on them, they pretend to be showing for the ball, they pretend to want to be protagonists, but they don't. Now, that's not Vinicius, and that is useful while we're in a process of development. But, but boys, Johnny just asked me about quality in La Liga. Believe me, Vinicius is quality.
Right, that's good news. It seems that he's been kind of almost incorrectly labelled as a certain player at this point, but possibly unfairly so, and I think definitely unfairly so if you look at the evidence of the weekend. Just before we let you go, Graham, Sven-Goran Eriksson, he's on the big interview podcast this week. interesting stuff about David Beckham in this piece.
Yes, about David. Thank you for mentioning that. That's not prearranged in case anybody's worried. Look, we travelled that week. We travelled 9,000 kilometres round trip to go up to Sunne to see Sven-Göran Eriksson. And I was interested myself in what we might get. I promise you, on my honour, and everybody listening into Off the Ball AM, Sven-Göran Eriksson, when he begins to talk about Sinisa Mihajlovic, Roberto Mancini, and then Beckham, is the best audio in our 97 interviews that we've done and 14 million listens. He's extraordinary on Mancini. The depth that he goes into in describing the man, the footballer, the coach, his foibles, his flaws, his positives. And then Sven, without me asking him to do so, leaps on and goes, yeah, but he's no David Beckham. And sitting across the table from him, when he builds Mancini up in such depth, and remember this is 20 years now since Sven became the only coach to take Lazio to Serie A title, only the second Swede to win the Scudetto in Italy after Nils Lidholm. He's extraordinarily different from the man, again, who was pigeonholed as coach of England, leaving Lazio immediately after winning the title. It's an interview that, you know, I swear people will get a lot back from if they choose to listen to it. He's an extraordinarily interesting and still very, very vital man.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Good stuff, Graham. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Pleasure.
Graham Hunter there on the line chatting El Clasico. Right, it is 11 minutes past 9 on this Tuesday morning. You're watching OTB AM. Now let's hear from Áine O'Gorman because she's making her return to international football on Thursday night at Ireland's sold-out qualifier against Greece, where she'll win her 101st cap.
You've come out of international retirement. Where did this decision come out of? And I guess I'm sure you're happy and delighted to be here as well.
Yeah, I think so. I am really happy to be here. I think I've just slotted back in. It's like I never left, really, to be honest, and really looking forward to the games. Yeah, I think it just came about like a couple of weeks ago, and Vera gave me a call. Obviously, there's a few injuries in the squad or whatever, and obviously I was delighted to be called back into to the new setup as well. And I think I'd regret it if I didn't take up the opportunity.
There's obviously a bit of I guess injury crisis is a bit of a strong word to use in defence. We're more commonly seeing you closer to the opposition goal, but is it fair to say that you're kind of going to be utilised in a more defensive role this time around?
Yeah, I think so, and I think in the international setup it's not a position that I'm not familiar with. I've played there before in the past, both right and left foot full-back position, so commonly for my club and in my international career I would have fancied myself up front or on the wing as well, but look, I'm just happy to be here and help the team out in whatever way I can.
And was this something Vera Pauw approached you about, or was it kind of the communication lines were always kept open, or who approached who, I guess?
Yeah, I think the communication lines were always kept open. I've had a discussion with Vera in the past as well. Look, this opportunity came. She just gave me a shout, and I was there to take the opportunity.
I'm sure you've been keeping track of a lot of the recent results in Group I. It's quite a tight group. Obviously, two wins and a draw. Perhaps the draw against Greece was a little bit disappointing, given it was such a late equaliser. But it's probably fair to say this game on Thursday night against Greece and next Wednesday against Montenegro away, 6 points from six is a must.
Yeah, I think so. I think that has to be the goal, 6 from 6, if you want to maintain that second position in the group and look forward to qualification. I think it was just the nature and the way the girls can see the goal late in the game, but look, we'll be looking to put that right in Tala on Thursday.
You've got some Piemont United colleagues with you as well, Claire Walsh, I know, and Nia Farrelly, and a few others as well. Stephanie Roach not on the panel this time, but of course she's back with Piemont now as well. That must make it quite easy to slot in. Obviously, you're one of the more experienced players, but it must be nice to have a few of the Piemont girls in the team as well.
Yeah, I think it's great, and obviously it's great for the Women's National League as well that there's representation from the league, and obviously Piemont, the club as well. And look, we've got a great squad now moving into the season, and with European football coming up as well. So, yeah, no, it's brilliant. And look, I would have been still in touch with a lot of the girls and still quite close to the girls from previous squads.
What impact has Vera had so far? Obviously, she came in, I think it was last September. So we're around 6 months in the job now, so enough time to probably put a label on how she's doing so far. But no complaints from the players, I guess?
No, I don't think so. I think Vera's very approachable. She's very clear in her philosophy and the way we're going to play. And it is quite an attacking kind of style of football, and put pressure on teams when needs be as well. So it's quite a nice, relaxed environment, very professional as well. And it's clear in the philosophy. So I think everyone seems really happy around camp.
This is OTB Sports Radio, Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Who was that talking?
Troy Deeney.
Well, I think he should keep his mouth shut and have more respect for the opposition when he plays against them. And look at himself. If he was such a great player and was able to do all the things that he's talking to other people not doing, he wouldn't be on the bench. He'd be out there playing.
The best analysis of all the week's football from Ireland's number one football man.
Obviously, after the Munich air disaster, it was thrust on Bobby. And there was an awful lot of pressure on Bobby. He was carrying the team and he handled himself brilliantly. He played unbelievable stuff.
John Giles. Every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio. Live 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
9:15, you're watching OTB AM, and it is Technology Tuesday with Jess Kelly, our newly christened slot there. I'm very proud of myself. I feel like Don Draper right now.
Just came off with it there.
Alliteration at 9:15 in the morning is impressive.
Yeah.
Well,
absolutely
done.
Absolutely fantastic. It is News Talk's tech correspondent, Jess Kelly. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
You might start with the coronavirus. We've been chatting about it all morning. Yes. We've been locked in the studio away for the last 2 hours. There's been a couple of new developments.
There have, yeah. So yesterday evening, you may have seen the news, Google announced that it was going to encourage its 8,000 employees in Dublin to work from home. This is anyone who's working on the Barrow Street offices. So anyone familiar with Dublin will know that Google have two big buildings in the heart of the city. And an employee yesterday reported with flu-like symptoms. They don't think it's coronavirus. It's not been confirmed as coronavirus. But they've taken this opportunity to push everyone to test a work-from-home day. What impact would it have on the company? Can everyone get their stuff done? If not, what do they need to implement? Because it could happen that a case of coronavirus does hit any of these big companies and then they have to adapt. What's happened this morning is that Twitter, their global HR chief, has issued a blog post, as you do, saying that, again, they're encouraging all of their staff from around the world to work from home if they can. The key point is that they're saying their business and their offices are still open. So if someone would prefer to go into the office or if they can't work from home, they are welcome to go in, but they are very much about containing the virus all around the world. It's not just here in Dublin. They have about 5,000 employees. Last week, they put a stop on any non-essential travel and any events. And I think that's something that we're going to see more of. So we know, obviously, rugby has been impacted thus far. It's likely that more and more of these events, you know, we know it's International Women's Day coming up on Sunday. There's a lot of events, a lot of these big corporate companies are hosting events. I'd say a lot of those are, you know, under the spotlight now, saying, do we really need to have all of these people coming into our offices or going to one venue for an hour or 2 hours for this event? So I'd say there's going to be a lot of questions. I know the Cabinet is meeting this morning and we're expecting to hear from Simon Harris later on today about what could happen.
Well, that's the key thing, because all the newspapers this morning are positive on the sports front, but it's not up to the sports bodies.
Nope.
It's up to Simon Harris. It's up to the government to actually tell us whether or not these events are going to go ahead. So it's actually a little bit futile reading. The Six Nations have met in Paris and they've given the green light to this sort of thing. It's not their call.
It's interesting as well that Simon Harris was given a bit of a chastising or wrapping the knuckles from Leo Varadkar, according to the Business Post, the weekend for the way he dealt with the Ireland-Italy game. So he's going to be very keen to be very, very forthright from here on about how he deals with these things.
Yeah, like, I think it has to be acknowledged that no minister, no politician, no person wants to be faced with pulling the plug on something that brings a hell of a lot of money into a city or a country or indeed a business. So I think none of these decisions will be taken lightly. But if you've watched any of the press conferences with the chief medical officer over the last number of days, they're taking it as seriously as they can. You know, I saw some people last night taking the mick because the deputy chief medical officer was drawing little stick men trying to illustrate how the disease or the illness is passed from person to person. But it is something serious. And I think if you listen to what Simon Harris was saying, particularly around the decision about the rugby, Like, if you're sitting in a stadium for a few hours next to a large group of people who are all shouting and spitting and being gross all around you, do you really want to take that risk just for the sake of a game that could be postponed or put on at a later date? I do think a lot of businesses around the country now this morning will be having that, you know, conversation of what is essential and what is not essential. And, you know, I know a lot of my friends who work in different organisations will be going in saying, you know, do we have the tools to work from home? GDPR, which is my favourite topic in the world, comes into play because you may have a laptop that can hook up to the internet and a phone that can call out. But from data protection point of view, can you access confidential work files out of the workplace? All of these sort of unsexy subjects come into play. Mm. And what we don't want is it having a huge impact on our economy, as we heard it could do yesterday. But again, it's worth noting we only have one confirmed case in the country at this moment in time. All of this stuff is precaution, and people are, you know, encouraged to go to the HSE website and follow the advice that's there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, though, from what we're seeing today, when you actually think about it, the Italy game was the only real one that we had to deal with. Everything, like, our big sporting events are in Cheltenham, in Paris, in Slovakia. So that's, I guess, away from our shores a little bit. So we went to see what other governments say as well. We wanted to talk about virtual reality this morning, Jess. Yeah. We've spoken about this with you before on the show, where you told us about this brave new world where you put on a headset and you will feel like you're at a golf course, for example. What golf course? I can't even remember what golf course it was that implemented this in the first place. And you start to think to yourself, this is going to happen very quickly because it's a very immersive experience. Yep. And it seems that it's kind of stalled a little bit in the last couple of years.
Yeah, so I think it was 3 or 4 years ago that we were talking about that on the show. And, you know, you put the headset on and you can walk up to the 18th tee or whatever it is and you can get that full experience. And it did seem to die away. I think what happened with virtual reality was the novelty factor came into play. I remember a few years ago, all of us here in the office being taken into one of the studios to try on this big Oculus Rift headset. And the extent of what they could do was make you feel like you're going on a roller coaster. So you're sitting in a chair, but you're simulated to go through a roller coaster. And all that really happened was we all kind of wanted to puke after 5 minutes. That was the height of it. So it didn't really go anywhere in terms of us seeing the value and buying into it. What then happened was a number of companies like PlayStation brought out their PSVR, and it became a big thing in gaming. So again, when the PSVR came out, we had it here in the office and everyone got to feel like Batman for a few minutes and could, like, you know, pick up things off the bat belt and throw them. And that was, again, fun and cool. But these files, and again, it comes down to uncool stuff, but these video files and these game files were so massive that they couldn't actually produce enough games to warrant people going out and buying the headset and keeping up that appetite. What we're seeing now with virtual reality is that businesses are starting to utilise it. So if you work for a company that fixes telephone lines, for example, there's an Irish company called VRAI, and what they do is they make training videos to simulate someone climbing up a telephone pole in really bad weather, trying to get the job done, trying to pick things up, trying to adjust to the heights, all of that sort of thing, so that your first port of call when you're training for that job is not to go out and fingers crossed don't fall, but to put on the video and go through the simulation. We're seeing it when I was in the UK last year. The West Midlands Police are using virtual reality. Instead of getting penalty points on your license as part of a pilot program, you could sit through a 12-minute virtual reality video, again, of a simulation of either drink driving or speeding, and have to face that full consequence from a collision impact right through to being lifted out of the car, taken into a hospital. And it is one of the most upsetting, horrific, shaky to your core kind of simulations that I've ever experienced. And so there are real world cases for it. What we're seeing now is the big tech companies, particularly sport companies, particularly in the US, like the NFL, utilising it to try and offer different experiences. The one we're seeing most impact at the moment is if a player is injured and they're out of the game for a long period of time, they can wear the VR headset to firstly get the simulation of being back on the field, being back involved in the game, but also try and, you know, simulate the reality so that their mental sharpness stays
and their plays get up to speed on what they're seeing in front of them.
Exactly, yeah. And you may think, oh, like, we survived long enough. The video that we're showing there is actually a video from the NFL. And although it looks like, I actually recorded this myself this morning, so you can go on to YouTube now and you can put in NFL 360 video. And if you have a VR headset at home, if you put that on, you can actually look all around you. So if you look up, you'll see the ceiling. If you look around, you'll see behind you, all of these different things. And again, you see when we're on the pitch there, you can see the players running by you. You can go up towards the referee. You can look out into the crowd when someone scores and just get a different perspective. So from a fan's point of view, that's what's happening in the NFL now. The way this is set up is you can buy 360 cameras. So the one that we had in the studio a few years ago was the Samsung 360. And it just captures every single bit that you can see there now. What a lot of them are doing is having sort of a bouquet of GoPros shooting in every direction, being processed really quickly to offer that experience. Again, if you think of what you were doing at the Rugby World Cup, imagine what we could get from some of your video vox pops if you had that full 360.
Nobody wants to see that.
I do. You could get that full 360 experience. The way this is supposed to work, and the thing that I'd be interested to see what your take is, that so you put on the headset, which is like it's like a goggles, like a big black box that you put on over your eyes, and then for it to fully work, you're supposed to have headphones in so that you are completely immersed and you are getting that full simulation. But if you're a fan watching at home, is that really how you want to experience sport? Do you want to be able to look behind you and see someone screaming in the crowd, or look to your right and see someone injured? I just don't know if particularly in Ireland anyway, if the fan experience is that hungry for that type of immersion just yet.
I think the answer to your question is no.
Yeah.
I think that there is a certain benefit actually to sitting at home, and that is
it would have been great in Tala on Saturday, like, rather than, like, you know, in the middle of a storm.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, it was
yeah.
absolutely horrible. I was horrible afterwards. It would have been great then.
Yeah, like, I get that, and I get the huge novelty value of, like, being in your living room, turning around and seeing fans everywhere. But if you're in your living room yeah. watching whatever sport it is,
yeah,
there is a huge benefit to that, because there is a television company after producing the perfect camera angles for you. Why would you want to put on a VR headset and get a worse view of the game that you can just turn on your television and watch? Because you have a worse game, a worse view at every game you attend. The reason you attend a game is not to see more. The reason you attend a game is to get the atmosphere and to cheer on your team.
You're not supposed to be giving your team that audible support at the game, you know, that you're not going to give them when you're at home.
That's what I mean. So exactly. The reason to go is to support your team.
The atmosphere,
so
yeah.
like the reason you go to a game is, so I just don't understand why you would do that from a remote location.
I think what the...
Because you can't influence the outcome, or you can't really experience what's going on in the stands around you.
What the argument that I've heard, again, in the US, when I was at CES earlier this year, there was a huge push towards VR. And what they were saying from the fans' point of view is that if you want to go to something like the Super Bowl and you can't afford a ticket, if you buy, you know, one of these passes to watch the game, as a lot of people would, you could then buy a VR pass and you could get the simulation and the experience that you're there, and you get to experience the halftime show. I don't think we're there yet, but I do wonder if we're going to get there. You know, as you can see there again, it is like you're standing there with them. One of the saddest videos I think I've ever seen in my entire life was the snooker player Ronnie O'Sullivan using a virtual reality headset, and he was holding a thing in his right hand and a thing in his left hand that simulated the cue. And he was so immersed in it that he forgot there wasn't a table and he fell over onto his face. And it's on YouTube. Again, it's one of my favourite videos that you should definitely watch. Another way this is becoming a little bit popular, but I don't know if it's going to catch on, is in music as well. So Paul McCartney a few years ago invested in a VR company, and the idea is that somebody at one of his gigs will stand there with one of those 360 cameras recording the sound, so that if you can't make it to the gig, if he's not coming to your town, or if you don't want to buy a ticket or can't afford to buy a ticket, you can pay like a tenner for the VR stream, put it on, and suddenly you're standing in the middle of a Paul McCartney gig in your house.
I think that makes a little bit more sense than a sporting event. You don't need to see a replay of a Paul McCartney song.
Well,
no, once is enough.
No, second encore, there you go.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm intrigued by it, and I do think we're going to see more and more of it. I do, for now anyway, I think we're...
What sort of bunch are we talking about? What sort of money are we talking?
For it, so you can buy the cheapo ones in, like, you know, Lidl and Aldi for 30 quid.
Really?
Yeah, and you can put it in. A lot of it does depend on the phone that you have. So what you can do is, there are so many of these VR 360 videos on YouTube. If you want to go on and put that into YouTube, you will see a lot of them. That's the NFL one that we were just watching there now. And once you put it on, again, you're fully immersed. For the serious heavy-duty ones, and the ones that would be used in the cases like the NFL players who were injured, that kind of stuff, you are talking close to a grand, maybe 2 grand, because not only are you buying the heavy-duty headset, it's also wired in, fully wired into a big heavy-duty computer to ensure that it can play those big files. So it is very much like everything in the world of tech, very budget dependent, but it doesn't have to break the bank. Like, you can experience it. There's actually Google Cardboard that you can go on. If you put into Google Cardboard, you can download a template, build it and make your own little one as well. So if you're into make and do, that's something for you. But as I said, I don't know that we're there yet in terms of me wanting to experience it.
It certainly seems that way, but like, it seems that there is obviously a good bit of interest from investors to try and actually brush up this. Mm-hmm. This isn't the Nintendo Wii. It's not an immersive experience that is going to fizzle out mm-hmm. over a period of time. It seems that there's enough investment in this because it is so versatile in terms of people with different interests to actually take this thing to the next level. So I'm all for it. I'm just interested to see how it develops over the next few years. Mm-hmm. Listen, Jess Kelly, thanks many for popping in.
Thank you.
It's Technology Tuesdays. It'll be back again at some time in the near future.
PT Classic.
Which is that?
I think, is that not some sort of like... sport where the TT, is that not the bikes maybe?
Oh, the bike racing.
TT?
Yeah.
I think so.
The speedway, you mean?
Is
that sort of thing.
TT. Could look it up.
I could look it up in just a moment.
It'd be good for the old virtual
very
reality.
Arduous, all
we will be back in just a moment. But after his remarkable goal against Shamrock Rovers was seen across the world, Dundalk's Jordan Flores joined After Ball last night and discussed the set piece plan that brought the strike together.
I usually go out short for corners with Mickey, and after the goal I scored against Cork, we decided to switch it up and hopefully something would drop to me at the edge of the box. And then we worked on that set piece, and I went a few times in training with my head and missed the target, so I thought, why not, I'll volley it this time.
Okay, I was wondering, because I presume, yeah, in training, you're meant to head that ball usually.
Yeah, that was the case, yeah, but just something... The way I reacted and the ball coming over, I didn't think it was that high. Mm. So I've just gone with the volley and then, yeah, it's got in.
When a ball's coming at you like that, so you know, you see the flight of it, you probably realise, I'm not being marked here, I'm going to get a crack at this. Are you thinking about just getting your kind of foot over the ball and keeping it down? Are you trying to put power on the ball, or are you just trying to use the pace that's on the ball? Like, what's flying through your head in that millisecond where you have to react?
You kind of just see it dropping down, and you have to watch it onto your foot, and you know, you're just thinking about making a good connection. Mm. And as you're seeing, if you make a good connection, then the power of the ball just looks after itself. So yeah, it's just all about making a good connection.
Yeah, full piece available on youtube.com/afterball. What a goal! Does the goalkeeper's parry affect your thinking on this, Johnny?
It was one of these, like, sometimes, you know, like Jebediah Springfield, sometimes the myth is better than the reality. So as Sleeves Elliott, you know, tweeted, I don't think we needed to see that angle where it kind of hit off Manus. To me, it only slightly takes away from the goal, because it's virtually impossible for a goalie to save that, because first of all, he has to react to the ridiculousness of him actually shooting in the first place, which nobody's going to do, and then it has to pretty much hit him in the head, which it didn't. So I was a little bit disappointed when I saw that view of it, but holy crap, the technique is just utterly ridiculous and great for Irish football. I mean, that had over 5 million hits last night, and just to be seen, it's all over the world and in a good stadium. And Flores actually had a poor game apart from that. It was funny, I watched the whole game back last night. I think Vinnie Pertle will be saying to him, you need to do more in general play, but he'll never be forgotten, because that goal was it was possibly the best volley I've ever seen. Like, it was definitely up there, but Van Basten's incredible. But for his left leg to be that high, and the strength of the standing leg to be able to kind of pivot from the position he was in, unbelievable technique, like unbelievable. And but they lost the game, and you know, the 3 points behind Shamrock Rovers. But he's going to go down in League of Ireland's immortality.
Yeah, for sure. And there's probably going to be more said about that goal as well over the next few months. Listen, Johnny, thanks a million for popping in.
It's been fun. I haven't been in a while. You know, it's that early start, and you're groggy, but you feel better for it. It's a bit like going to the gym.
Absolutely.
From what I remember.
If you don't see you, enjoy the stay next week, and Godspeed with Cheltenham.
This is it.
That is your lot this morning for OTB AM. We are back on air tomorrow morning from 7:30 in all the usual places. Don't forget, Off the Ball live tonight on your radios from 7:00. We'll chat to you tomorrow morning. Bye bye for now.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.